Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6,
E is equal MC squared, in which energy is
all steps for man.
The human genome is our shared inheritance. And it is sitting at the
cracks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. When it comes to weight and diet, I guess you could call me one of the lucky ones. I've never been on a diet in my life, and I pretty much eat whatever I want and still manage to stay reasonably thin. But I know that many, if not most, North Americans struggle daily with their weight, and diet books are perennial bestsellers. We tend to dismiss those books as passing fads, but our first guest today claims that some of those diets might hold the key to both weight control and a healthy heart. Be prepared to have all your accepted wisdom overturned. Plus, we'll learn about a tropical bird that likes to invest in timeshares. We'll hear about an ancient pre-Aztec beer that was made from chocolate. And we'll meet the Canadian scientist who's trying to understand why astronauts faint when they return to Earth. But first, the big fat lie. This is Quirks and Quarks. What if I told you that everything your doctor said to you about healthy eating and exercise was wrong? That cutting down your fatty food intake and going out for a brisk walk 3 times a week wasn't a good way to lose weight? You'd probably think I was crazy. But that's the premise laid out in a new book by Gary Taubes. Mr. Taubes is an award-winning science writer based in New York. His new book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, takes a critical look at the science behind obesity research and finds the research is a little thin. In fact, the book suggests our entire approach to dieting in modern society is probably at best misguided and at worst dangerous. Mr. Taubes, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
Okay, let's get straight to the issue here. We'll get into the details in a moment, but what's the basic message you have in your book here?
The basic message is that for 50 years we've considered dietary fat and calories to be the excess calories to be the cause of chronic diseases and obesity. You know, we eat too much, we eat too much fat, and that's what makes us sick, and that's what makes us obese or overweight. And when you actually look at the science, which for some reason nobody else has ever done in this to sort of this rigorous extent, you find that carbohydrates are the primary problems. It seems to be the quality and the quantity of the carbs in our diet that make us sick and that make us fat.
So it's not the fat in, fat out. It's carbohydrates that are the bad guys here.
It is indeed carbohydrates. When it comes to weight regulation, that's the most interesting story, and I spend a good half of the book on it. You know, the idea is we get fat because we consume more calories than we expend, and these excess calories fall into our fat tissue like it's a garbage can where you put things you don't need. That's been the conventional wisdom since the end of the Second World War. The reality is that our fat tissue is very well regulated. And like many homeostatic systems in our body, homeostatic is a term that means systems like blood pressure and temperature that our body tries to maintain stable. Like many of these systems, our fat tissue is regulated by hormones, and it's very carefully regulated. So fat only goes into it when it's allowed to go into it, and only comes out of it, or it especially comes out of it when we need it. And what I point out in the book is that this regulation of fat tissue was worked out in the 1950s and 1960s, and yet the obesity research community has never considered it relevant to the question of why we accumulate excess fat in that fat tissue.
Well, where did modern health advice, this idea that, you know, you are what you eat, you know, if it starts out as fat, it's going to end up as fat, where did that idea and your idea that, no, it's carbohydrates, or this idea that you say came around 50 years ago, when did those two begin to diverge?
Well, in the 1950s, a fellow named Ansel Keys, a nutritionist at the University of Minnesota, got the idea that it was dietary fat that made us fat and gave us heart disease. And Keys was something of a zealot. once he got a hypothesis, he wasn't going to let it go, and he was going to brook no opposition. And through the 1960s, this idea, at first it was total fat raises cholesterol, and that gives us heart disease. And then it evolved into the idea that it was saturated fat that raises cholesterol and gives us heart disease. This hypothesis slowly worked its way first to the American Heart Association, then to the press. And it got to the point that people began to believe it, even though, in effect, no studies had ever proven it to be true. And the problem is, if fat is bad for you, then what you do is recommend a low-fat diet. But a low-fat diet, by definition, is a high-carbohydrate diet. And there was always this competing hypothesis that carbohydrates are fattening. This is what our parents believed. Bread, pasta, pastries, potatoes, beer, you know, that these things somehow make you fat. And because the heart disease, the fat heart disease hypothesis caught on, this idea that carbohydrates are fattening had to be dumped. You know, it couldn't be reconciled with the other hypothesis. One of them had to go, and the one that went was the carb hypothesis. And when I, again, when I went back to look for data to, you know, evidence to explain why people ceased to believe that carbohydrates were fattening, you can't find it. You just find a political reason to get rid of it because it was inconvenient.
On the other hand, there's been years of research that have gone into showing this connection between fatty foods and obesity.
In fact, there haven't. What you find is Western societies that eat fatty foods tend to be fatter than societies that don't, you know, Asian societies that live on high-carbohydrate diets. But Western societies that eat fatty foods also eat, for instance, a lot of sugar. And one of the ideas that I suggest in the book, and again, because no real research has been done to test this, it's quite possible that sugar is the primary problem. High fructose corn syrup is another version of sugar, and that these together are what make us, you know, what really cause obesity and chronic diseases. But in, again, it, when you actually look for clinical control trials where they put people on high-fat diets versus low-fat diets, you find that, if anything, high-fat diets make them lose weight.
How so?
Well, again, if you look at the underlying regulation, you know, we look at the fat tissue. That's what I did. I just said, well, this is interesting. You know, one of the points I note in the book, I go looking for populations where people try to get fat. For instance, there are, you know, African populations in the 19th century, tribes where they like to fatten up the women before marriage. And in those cases, they would fatten them up. Where you could find evidence what they fed them, they would fatten up them up on milk, which is mostly lactose, a carbohydrate, and sorghum, which is an old world grain. But you never find a population where they fatten people up on meat. Sumo wrestlers. There's a good example of, you know, a population where you're trying to get as fat as humanly possible. And what you find out is that the sumo wrestlers actually eat a very low-fat, very high-carbohydrate diet. It's about 5,000 calories a day, of which about 10% is fat. So when you look for populations where the people want to get fat, they do it on high-carb diets. And then when you look at studies where people want to get thin, you find that the Atkins diet, a very low-carbohydrate diet, invariably leads to more weight loss than any other diet you try to put people on.
Okay, you've been talking about the input here, whether it's fat or carbohydrates, but you also in your book talk about the output, which is exercise. So what role is that playing in obesity?
Well, this is the idea that, you know, we gain weight because we consume more calories than we expend. Consuming less historically has never been shown to work unless you actually starve someone. So the alternative is maybe if we somehow expend more, that will solve the problem. You know, one of the problems, if you actually look back to the 1950s, again, I did this, and you read what clinicians who treated obese patients said in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, they never recommended exercise for obesity for two primary reasons. The foremost is that exercise makes you hungry. Remember this idea of working up an appetite? You go for a walk, you play 18 holes of golf, you play a couple sets of tennis, you work up an appetite. You come home and you eat. And again, 50 years ago, this wasn't, you know, this was obvious that clinicians would say, I don't want to tell my fat patients to go work out, because if they do, they'll just get hungry and they'll come back, and sometimes they'll treat themselves to more calories than they actually expended. And then the second thing they would say is it's very hard to burn considerable amount of calories by exercising. So, you know, if I have an obese patient, I tell him to walk for an hour. I'm not going to tell him to go for a jog because, remember, he's obese. We don't want him to have a heart attack. We don't want his knees to give out. But I tell him to walk vigorously for an hour. He might burn an extra couple hundred calories. That's the equivalent to maybe three slices of bread. Why not just tell him not to eat the bread? You know, and all of this was obvious. And then one clinician comes along, one nutritionist, a very, very, very prominent one, Jean Maillard at Harvard, who was the most prominent nutritionist in the country in the 1960s. And Maillard says, oh, no, no, actually, you don't get hungry after exercising. It's okay. There's a loophole. And what he said is you can be so sedentary that you still have more appetite than if you exercise a little, and fat people must be that sedentary. He did this based on one animal experiment and one sort of bizarre observational study of workers in a mill in India. And based on these two studies, he decided that exercise was the reason we get fat is because we're sedentary. And the way to lose the weight is to exercise, and that we could just exercise and not get hungry afterwards. And, you know, again, it's hard to believe, but this one prominent nutritionist, in effect, convinced, you know, it spread out in this infectious way until today. To say that you don't lose weight by exercising is, again, to be treated as a quack.
Now, you're not saying, though, that exercise isn't beneficial for other reasons, right?
You know, it may indeed be. Certainly, people who exercise tend to be healthier than people who don't, and they tend to be leaner, although the studies don't actually demonstrate that it's exercise that makes them healthy and makes them lean. It could be the fact that they're healthy and lean to begin with makes them more likely to exercise. You know, I assume exercise is good for a lot of things because a lot of good scientists say so, but, you know, it also makes orthopedic surgeons very rich.
So how is it that so many smart researchers have missed what you've shown in the book about the problems with the roles of fat and exercise?
You know, that's always the rub with a book like mine. I used to say, you know, I spend my career reporting about controversial science. I wrote a book about cold fusion to chemists from the University of Utah who believed they had discovered nuclear fusion in a glass of heavy water, something a lot of very smart people would have had to miss. And when you approach this kind of story, if I was writing a story about me, I would work from the assumption that I was a quack until proven otherwise. On the other hand, when you actually, you know, I'm not talking about anything these researchers don't know. I describe an interview I had in the press with a fellow who used to be a famous diabetes specialist. And he co-edited an 800-page handbook on the metabolism of fat tissue that was published by the American Physiological Society in 1965. And in this handbook, every chapter basically says that carbohydrates drive insulin response and insulin drives fat accumulation. Now, one of the things you do as a science journalist is you think, well, okay, that was the case in 1965. Maybe it's been disproven. Maybe a new technology came along and showed that wasn't true. So you find an authority who knew the science in 65, who's still around today. And there I found this, you know, fellow who edited the textbook, this handbook. And I called him up and I said, you know, every chapter in this handbook, 800 pages, basically says carbohydrates drive insulin and insulin drives fat accumulation. And he said to me, well, that's true. Carbohydrates is driving insulin. Insulin is driving fat. And I said to him, what's the difference between saying carbohydrates is driving insulin and insulin is driving fat and saying that carbohydrates make you fat? Aren't those two sentences equivalent? And his response was, well, we know what makes you fat. It's not carbohydrates. It's sedentary behavior. These people were so, as far as I can tell, they were so locked into this sort of biblical view of obesity, that fat people are fat because they are either gluttonous or slothful. You know, gluttony or sloth make you fat, that even when their own science showed them that it was one particular nutrient in the diet and its effect on hormones that caused you fat, they couldn't and refused to see it. And I'm still stunned. I mean, it shocks me that something that seems so simple could be considered irrelevant.
So if you're saying then that it's this link between carbohydrates and insulin and the way insulin controls the storage of fat in the body, How has all of this come together to cause what's being called the obesity epidemic in North America right now? How has that all come to play?
Well, as I said, you know, in the 1970s, we bought into this hypothesis that fat was the killer. Fat made us fat. And if you remember the 1980s, that was the beginning of the low-fat generation. There was even this belief that you could not add fat. You could not get fat if you didn't eat fat. So we all, you know, pasta and potatoes, you know, became heart-healthy diet foods. Sugar consumption went up because suddenly, you know, it couldn't be sugar making you fat because we know it's fat making you fat. So beginning in the 1980s, we had this message that we were all supposed to eat low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets. We were supposed to eat precisely the foods that our parents' generation and back a century before them believed, based on their own anecdotal experience, made them fat. And we did. And this shift is almost unique. I've never seen anything like it, where suddenly a whole world starts consuming these low-fat, high-carb diets, and then lo and behold, it coincides with an explosion of obesity and diabetes, and the medical community responds by saying, well, we didn't try hard enough.
So does this mean that all those fad diets like Atkins, South Beach, and the Zone are right?
Well, in effect, obviously that's what I believe. The other fact is they're not fad diets. They have been labeled fad diets because they, primarily beginning with the American Medical Association, the American Heart Association, because they, you know, contradicted the advice that we should all eat low-fat diets. But these diets existed back 150 years. In fact, you know, one thing I did, which for some reason the medical researchers don't seem, you know, didn't think to do themselves, I just went back to the medical journals. And what you find is that when you went into hospitals, if you were overweight, they put you on a low-carb diet. They said, don't eat potatoes, pasta, rice. You know, that's the primary thing. There were even, you know, textbooks that said you could eat anything you wanted, as much meat as you wanted, just like Atkins did. Just don't eat these fattening carbohydrates. And then in 1960, the American Heart Association decides that a low-fat diet is healthy, and therefore a low-fat diet must also lead to weight loss because fat has less, is denser calories than carbohydrates and protein. So if you take the densest calories out of the diet, you'll lose weight. And without any studies, without any evidence, they just start promoting this as the somehow, you know, the establishment diet and claiming that the diet that had been recommended for 100 years previously was a fad.
Now we are dealing in the realm of hypothesis here, though.
Never in my book do I ever use anything but the word hypothesis.
Yes. But throughout the book, you point out how researchers have ignored data that didn't support their preconceived conclusions. How concerned are you that you might have done the same thing?
I wouldn't say I ignored any data. I've left things out of the book. The early draft of this book was twice as long. This is a big book. At one point, I had a 400,000-word unfinished draft.
Whoa.
And because what I did in that draft is I addressed every argument and every counterargument, the counterarguments to the counterarguments to the counterarguments. And I finally, my editor took it from me and he read it and he said, stop that. Give the basic argument, your counterargument, and when you lecture at a university, should they be kind enough to invite you, you can discuss the counterarguments. What you look for is evidence that refutes your hypothesis. You try to generate it in an ideal world, and the end of my book is a plea to the medical establishment to actually fund the kinds of studies necessary to refute this hypothesis if it's wrong. And the problem with this carbohydrate hypothesis is it's very compelling, and it explains virtually all of the evidence.
So just one last thing. Where does this leave the person in the street who is concerned about their diet, wants to do something about it, but they're now getting conflicting messages? On one side, fat is bad. On the other side, carbohydrates are bad. What's the person in the street to do?
Well, you know, my obvious knee-jerk self-serving response is to say read the book and decide for yourself. I wrote it for the intelligent layman, but I also wrote it for the medical research community and for physicians everywhere. So I'm hoping that they'll all read it. You know, again, I wouldn't, if I heard myself on the radio saying this, it would be hard for me to say, well, Taub sounds more right than my doctor, therefore I'm going to listen to him. It's, This conflict has existed for 150 years between this carbohydrate hypothesis, well, actually 100 years between the carbohydrate hypothesis and the calorie hypothesis. And the reason books like Atkins have been around for 30, 40 years is because it's so easy to lose weight on the low-carbohydrate diet. The problem is you don't get any support from the medical research community from doing it. Your doctors tell you you're going to kill yourself. So I said to my editor, I have to write a book that speaks to the doctors in the medical research community, writing another diet book that tells, you know, the layperson that they could lose weight effortlessly if they go on this diet doesn't do a lot of good. It's a problem. What you're saying is a problem. You know, what does a layperson do? You know, other than read my book and decide for themselves and maybe give a copy to their physician and say, would you please read this and help me decide? They certainly can't make up their mind just reading the news reports or the reviews of my book. You know, again, the medical research establishment has a problem. We have this epidemic of obesity and diabetes. There's more and more. It's not going away. It's not tapering off. It's not plateauing. It's just getting worse. You know, I keep, every time I do one of these radio shows, I hope somebody listening in, there's somebody at, you know, your local university or, you know, the physicians listening in will say, well, he does make a little bit of sense. Let's pay attention. Let's read his arguments and, you know, take him seriously.
And there's more science to be done.
And there's more science to be done.
Mr. Taubes, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Gary Taubes is a science writer based in New York City. His new book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, is published by Knopf.